Welcome to Groundwire, the news program of Canada's National Campus and Community Radio Association, focusing on news from the people's perspectives. Today's episode of Groundwire is produced at CJSF FM, located on unceded Coast Salish lands in Burnaby, BC. I'm Nina Halliday on this edition of Groundwire.
On behalf of the province of British Columbia, and on behalf of this entire Legislative Assembly, we sincerely apologize for the province's historical wrongs.
I asked her what the slide into being trafficked looks like.
We'll groom her and lure her and entice her. And she ultimately begins to believe that he is her boyfriend.
And there's nothing like an illegal migrant as far as I'm concerned. And this country, especially this country, has been built only by migrants. So it's really a shame, the situation that we see now.
There's a lot of people that come out to this that wouldn't normally come out to it. Them getting to experience the record store, the absolute maximum effect.
First, the headlines.
This year's National Community Radio Conference is June 2nd to 7th, 2014. Presented by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, BC. Robin Spilker, 2014 NCRC coordinator, introduces highlights of this year in particular, including Radio Equity Day, Saturday, June 7th, where all community station members are welcome to attend the conference for free.
I think the value of the conference is connecting people and furthering campus community radio across the country. We don't always get to talk to each other because we are separated by geography. So the conference is a chance for all those folks to come together, to share skills, to get to know each other, and to build a movement. For us at CFUV, is a little bit of the theme of conference is moving beyond the airwaves as one and keeping radio relevant as another. Campus community radio is community-based, and social justice often focus is a huge strength because it's a way that we connect to our communities and we have influence outside of just radio. Partnerships with groups like Girls Rock Camp Victoria help out the community, and they also help us by being able to shape what is happening in music. Another feature of this conference that we're excited for is that we were able to get sponsorship from Factor. In doing that, are able to bring Weird Canada to the conference mm-hmm. to do a keynote and a number of events. Weird Canada is a grassroots, completely volunteer-based organization that's establishing across the country to support obscure and, I guess I'd say, weird music. It's great to have them out here and relates back again to making these connections beyond the airwaves.
That was Robin Spilker speaking about the 2014 National Community Radio Conference presented by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, June 2nd to 7th. Find out more about the conference at CFUVNCRC2014.com. This is Megan Thomas reporting for Groundwire from CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, BC.
Since 1978, the Government of Canada has increasingly issued so-called security certificates as a basis for imprisoning or deporting non-citizens. The certificate names an individual who is alleged to be a threat to national security, a human rights violator, or a member of organized crime. In 2007, the Supreme Court struck down the security certificate laws, so the government changed them. Carmen Chung, senior counsel at the BC Civil Liberties Association, told Groundwire what the problem was and how the law was revised.
The reason the court found it to be unconstitutional in 2007 was the use of secret evidence in secret trials. Because the named individuals on the security certificates had no way of knowing what the evidence being used against them was, their right to a fair trial was violated. The regime was changed after the Supreme Court's decision in 2007 to introduce the use of what was called special advocates. And these are security-cleared lawyers who have access to secret evidence and work in the interest of the named person.
On May 14, 2014, the Supreme Court upheld the revised law, rejecting a challenge by an Algerian-born refugee named Mohamed Harkat. Harkat was formerly imprisoned without trial under a security certificate, alleging ties to Al-Qaeda. Since his release, he's been fighting deportation. The BCCLA testified that the revised security certificate law should still be considered unconstitutional.
The BCCLA is really concerned about the limitations that are placed on security cleared counsel. The special advocates, once they have access to the secret evidence, have a really strict communications ban that's placed on them so that they can't communicate with their with the named person or really anyone unless a judge gives them permission. I mean, at the end of the day, the Supreme Court this week upheld the revised version of the security certificate regime, but what they did was that they issued some very strong guidelines and remarks about the duties of judges hearing these cases to be very skeptical about government claims of secrecy.
That was Carmen Chung, senior counsel at the BC Civil Liberties Association. For Groundwire, I'm Frieda Worden at CJSF.
Sean Atleo is a hereditary chief from the Ahaushat First Nation. In July 2012, Atleo was elected to a second term as National Chief to the Assembly of First Nations. On Friday, May 2, 2014, Atleo held a press conference to publicly resign, saying he didn't want to be a lightning rod in the debate over First Nations education, referring to Bill C-33, the First Nations Education Act, which is now on hold. Gnarji O'Sullivan of Co-op Radio in Vancouver spoke to former Vice Chief Bill Wilson about Atleo's resignation.
He simply did not, as many other chiefs, advance the agenda very much further. I think what we have to recognize is that being an Indian means that you have to take on the government, not go to bed with it.
Because he seemed to be very interested in building relationships with the government.
Building relationships has to be based on mutual respect and dignity. And I know that Harper and his government, as successive federal governments and provincial governments, have never had any respect whatsoever for Indians. And the only time that Aboriginal people get their proper respect is when they stand up as individuals without being fearful of condemnation from the churches or from government or trying to curry favors. The Educational Act was obviously engineered to be put out there to get a reaction, and then, I'm quite surprised, though, that, in the face of a struggle and a fight, that a national chief would step back and say he didn't want to fight.
CJSF spoke to SFU's Office of Aboriginal Peoples. Director William Lindsay spoke to the resignation and had some notes on possibilities for the next chief of the Assembly of First Nations.
There's never been a history of this happening before. I'm not going to blame Mr. Atleo. I think it was a convergence of history and circumstances that really led to what happened this past week.
So what happens next?
There'll be a new national chief elected. Key thing that's going to happen here, the kind of personality and leadership skills of the next chief.
Are there any names to watch?
Yeah, absolutely. There's the Manitoba Grand Chief, Derek Nepinak. Probably Sean Atleo's most vocal critic. Perry Bellegarde from Saskatchewan. He's run previous and didn't win. Another one is Pam Palmateer from Ontario. She's a professor at Ryerson University. She ran second to Sean in the last election, so she was pretty close. And Jody Wilson-Raybould, who's the current head of the BC Assembly of First Nations, she's a little bit more conciliatory. She's not easily pushed around either. So, she might be the kind of choice that's more of a middle-of-the-road choice. So those are probably the four biggest names. There might be another dark horse, but those are the four big ones.
For Groundwire, this was Gnarji O'Sullivan reporting from CFRO in Vancouver and Megan Thomas reporting from CJSF in Burnaby.
You're listening to Groundwire, the news program of Canada's National Campus and Community Radio Association.
The first feature for this edition of Groundwire is brought to you by Amelie Philipson of CKUT in Montreal about Canadians who are currently detained in Egypt.
At the end of April, an Egyptian court recommended death sentences for almost 700 people, including the Supreme Guide of the Muslim Brotherhood, Mohamed Badi. How did Egypt fall from the hope and enthusiasm of the Arab Spring down into these mass arrests and this crackdown on human rights? In the summer of last year, there was a lot of discontent with Egypt's democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi. Ihab Lotayef from the Egyptian-Canadian Coalition for Democracy provides us with more background.
Many segments of society felt that they would like to see early elections. So there was also a group of people that probably had ulterior plans about that, and there was a movement that started demonstrations in the streets. Unfortunately, the military intervened in an unacceptable manner at that point, with the support of some prominent figures of society, religious leaders and the like, and a military coup took place where the president was deposed and actually first kidnapped, and nobody knew where he was taken, and then subjected to trial on bogus charges, really. And that is the starting point of what we are seeing today.
The Egyptian interim government is cracking down on all form of dissent and is calling all protests a form of terrorism.
The situation in Egypt is a situation where many forces in the political arena in Egypt would have seen and done anything to make sure that they get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Sarah Atia met her husband Khaled Al-Kazaz, a Canada permanent resident, whilst being a student at the University of Toronto. After their wedding, they moved to Cairo in 2005, opening an international school.
Soon after the revolution in Egypt, we were both very excited about the idea of democracy and freedom and, you know, a better Egypt. So Khaled became quickly involved. He joined the campaign team for President Morsi, and they won the first democratic elections. He was appointed, he was asked to come on the team as a staffer to the president. He was the secretary for the president for foreign affairs. On July 3rd, the day of the coup, Khaled did not come home. He was detained by the military with the president and eight other presidential aides. Now it's been 309 days, and he remains to be detained. Right now he's being held in the high security facility called Scorpion in Tora Prison, which is a notorious prison in Cairo for its notorious for its human rights violations and very severe conditions.
Canadian national and Al Jazeera English journalist Mohamed Fahmy has been detained in Egypt since December 29th. Foreign Affairs Minister Mr. Baird visited Egypt recently. Several organizations, including Amnesty International, came out with statements according to which the minister's trip to Egypt was inappropriate. Sama Elibiari from the Egyptian-Canadian Coalition for Democracy.
This visit gives a message that Canada is supporting the interim regime, which has no legitimacy, no credibility, and besides, which is a criminal regime. Can you imagine sentencing just a mass, so many people, 680, after one court session, and sentencing them to death? And what for?
Elections are coming up in Egypt at the end of the month, but Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, one of the candidates, is the military strongman that led the coup last July, and he is getting all the media attention he wants. Hamdine Sabahi, the second candidate from the left, made the choice of supporting the coup last year and chose to run in elections where he knows he has no chance of winning. Other potential candidates decided not to run in the election, knowing that the political atmosphere cannot lead to democratic elections. According to Ehab Lotayef, it is impossible to hold fair and clear elections in the context that Egypt has known since the July 3rd military coup, a military ruling of the country, including a crackdown on press freedom, freedom of expression, and human rights in general. Sama Elibiari insisted that it was not just those that were related to the Muslim Brotherhood who are victims of the interim government's policies.
In the papers, they say that only it's the supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood who have been detained, but it's anyone showing dissent for the government. It's not only one group, it's anybody who's opposing the present interim government.
Thanks to Sama Elibiari, Ehab Lotayef, and Sarah Atia. Amelie Philipson for Groundwire.
On May 15th, BC Premier Christy Clark pronounced an apology for more than 100 provincial laws, regulations, and policies that discriminated against people of Chinese descent between 1871 and 1947.
On behalf of the province of British Columbia, And on behalf of this entire Legislative Assembly, we sincerely apologize for the province's historical wrongs. We are sorry for the discriminatory legislation and racist policies enacted by past provincial governments. We will ensure that this never happens again.
Our family and many Head Tax families, many exclusion families, are rejecting the apology.
This is Sid Tan, who was brought from China as an infant by his grandparents, soon after Canada allowed ethnic Chinese to have rights. He's a community media producer and a longtime activist.
Today's apology is an apology, really, by the status quo politicians of today, apologizing for the racism and discrimination of status quo politicians 100 years ago, 50 years ago.
Tan points out a number of omissions from the apology. One is that it offers no restoration from the more than $8.5 million of head tax money that the province received from 1903 through 1925. Only Chinese people had to pay this head tax to come to Canada. In 1903, it was increased to $500 per person, a fortune at the time. When the federal government made its apology in 2006, it distributed a small amount of its share of the head tax money as reparation, says Sid Tan.
The federal government did apologize, and the federal government gave a $20,000 ex gratia payment to every surviving head taxpayer and the surviving spouse of a deceased head taxpayer. Some 82,000 head taxes were paid, and the government ex gratia payment settlement went to less than 800 families. That's less than 1% of all the families that paid the head tax.
Mm-hmm. Starting in 1923, the Exclusion Act decreed Chinese people could not come to Canada, no matter how much they might pay. Exclusion meant Chinese immigrants already in Canada could not reunify their families.
We find that this exclusion is actually more insidious than the head tax. The exclusion is, we don't want you, and I suppose a sovereign nation can do those kinds of things, but to do it on the basis of racism seems to me wrong. And this is what we're dealing with now, is that these elderly sons and daughters from the excluded wives or whose fathers weren't able to bring them to Canada when anybody else could bring their children and wives to Canada, this is blatantly unjust, and these people are still alive. Many of them have suffered hardship. They could tell you stories about what life was like in China, you know, waiting for a father to bring them to Canada. And on top of it, many of the males that were here were almost neutered by the fact that their wives and families thought they were pretty useless because they couldn't unite the family. I know that was the case in my family for my grandfather, who could never get my grandmother to understand why he couldn't bring her to Canada. There was a law forbidding it.
Sid Tan helps organize people affected by exclusion. He says they were ignored by BC when it framed the provincial apology.
We went to the public consultations. The public consultations that the public could go to. I should make it very clear that Head Tax Family Society of Canada, which is the reference group, for Head Tax Families, was never invited to a meeting with the minister, was never accorded the courtesy it should have had for its work in 30-some years of advocacy. We wouldn't even be talking about these apologies and things like that if it were not for redress-seeking groups. And what could be a better legacy from an apology than a just and honorable redress to the people that are still alive? They were totally, and they've always been, dismissed.
Groups still advocating for redress include the Chinese Canadian National Council and the group Sid Tan co-organized in BC, known as ACCESS, the Association of Chinese Canadians for Equality and Solidarity Society. For Groundwire, I'm Frieda Worden.
On Saturday, May 10, 2014, Solidarity Across Borders organized a brunch to raise money for Yvonne Hernandez.
I'm Yvonne Hernandez. I'm Mexican, and I'm facing deportation. And now I am fighting for to stay close to my son.
Yvonne is a Mexican immigrant fighting to stay in Canada with her 1.5-year-old son. Today, the government is threatening to send her back to Mexico without him. This would entail leaving full custody of her son to her ex-husband, whom she left because he was physically and psychologically abusive. I talked with Bruno, whose daughter got him involved with Solidarity Across Borders a few years ago.
Solidarity Without Borders. Oh, well, their goal. I totally agree with their goal that there shouldn't be anyone. You should be able to live everywhere you wish. And there's nothing like an illegal migrant, as far as I'm concerned. And this country, especially this country, has been built only by migrants after, of course, killing all those other people. So it's really a shame, the situation that we see now, that this government and those governments, as a matter of fact, they are like picking and choosing what kind of migrants they want. If they want them to work in a McDonald's in Calgary for 3 months and then get them out. So this is a nonsense. Everyone should have a right to live here and in decent conditions.
Just like Yvonne, more than 500,000 people in Canada live without papers today.
When I get without status, I start to look for information, for help. And in that point, I found Mexicanos Unidos por la Regularización and also Solidarity Across Borders. So since before, I met them. But now, when I left my husband and I went to the shelter, and my ex-husband started to put pressure on me for take my baby and to deport me and all that. So I look for Solidarity Across Borders and also for Medicine Du Monde and other people who was another organism who was helping me. That's why it's like one another. So
the fundraiser attracted families and friends to raise awareness about the problems that undocumented immigrants face. As one organizer said, one thing that's often overlooked in microjustice struggles is the role that mothers in situation of precarious status often play in these movements.
Be it by supporting other parents, be it by participating in assemblies or demonstrations, it's also difficult to overlook how important a role people like Yvonne and others play in visibilizing the struggles of survivors of violence and people living with immigration status when they speak out to the media.
The floor was open for participants to share their stories.
Renata vagyok. My name is Renata.
Két éve vagyok itt Kanadában.
I've been here for 2 years.
Három gyereknek az édesanyja.
I'm the mother of 3 children. The reason I left Hungary were my 3 children, because my children were not accepted in Hungary because of their origins. In Hungary, I never saw my children being happy the way I see them happy here. For example, it's been 2 years that I see my son going to school happily every day. I see him laugh every day. I learned how to be a happy mother here.
For more information and if you'd like to get involved, visit justicepouryvonne.org and solidarityacrossborders.org. For Groundwire, this was Clémentine Koenig.
This is Groundwire, the news program of Canada's National Campus and Community Radio Association. Next up is our Community Radio Report. For the third year in a row, community radio stations across Canada teamed up with independent record stores to broadcast live from their all-day celebrations of music, musicians, and the vinyl that captures the sound. Megan Thomas reports on Record Store Day in Vancouver.
On this edition of the Groundwire Community Radio Report, we highlight the CJSF-CITR Collaborative Live Broadcast of Record Store Day, April 19, 2014, in Vancouver, BC. The broadcast featured live music and interviews over 2 stations, 4 record stores, 7 hours, and 20 staff and volunteers. Here's a collection of excerpts, including segment hosts Jesse Wensloff and myself, Megan Thomas, comments from Ben Frith, operator at Neptune Records, and a visit from Canadian iconoclast Nardwar.
Welcome to CJSF and CITR's broadcast of Record Store Day 2013 at Neptune Records. I'm Jesse.
I'm Megan.
We have War Baby playing right now here at Neptune Records. Dead Soft is coming up.
Yep.
We're going to have interviews with bands, people involved in Record Store Day, people who love records.
All the coolest of the kids.
All right, do we want to send it to War Baby
now? Let's get in the War Baby, and then we will be back on CJSF and CITR for Record Store Day 2014.
A lot of people that come out to this that wouldn't normally come out to it, and I think them getting to experience the record store, the absolute maximum effect. You know, you get to see the live music, you get to see music lovers of all kind. It's really just an amazing experience. It's just such a fun, great day. We love it.
Why has the record store in particular survived when so much of the music industry hasn't?
Well, you know, I think we have something different to offer than a place like HMV. You know, HMV, like, especially towards the end, they weren't really carrying any kind of back catalog stuff. You know, they still have knowledgeable staff and everything, but I think it just, the bottom line became a bigger thing than taking chances on things. And a lot of these situations, the head guys aren't exactly the ones with the brains in the operation. It's the guys working in the shop. And, I know people that had worked in places like that, and they want to do something, and they can't. Their hands are tied on it. So I think a place like here, we have a direct relationship with the customers. So, you know, we really get to see what people want, hear what they want, and really work for them.
Yes, we are live at Neptune Records in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. It's been open since 8 a.m.,
That's a lot of music.
And I heard a rumor they may even be opening earlier next year. And it was apparently packed around the block. There was a lineup to get into Neptune Records here at Record
really?
Store Day. And right after this, I'm going to head up to Red Cat Records because Cool are going to play. They're going to have some bands playing. And we just heard War Baby just played. You know, CGSF, CITR really taking it up another notch here with the Sarah McLachlan type mics you guys have there.
Oh, yeah, I have a headset with
yeah,
that
how
with
could you describe that to the listeners out there in Radio Land?
The 1990s called. They want their airport transmitter headset back.
Pretty
Baboom.
Much.
Actually, it looks awesome. I love it. And you can see the customers are pushing by us. When you're in a record store, you guys are standing here right now in like kind of a main position. How do people push by you? How have you guys viewed the politenessness of record shoppers, just out of curiosity?
It's been pretty good.
We're maintaining the Canadian standard, I think.
Thank you to all the guests, staff, volunteers, and record stores who participated in this third annual CITR-CJSF collaborative broadcast showcasing the local music and personalities, which are big pieces of the community station puzzle here in the West Coast Lower Mainland. I'm Megan Thomas at CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, and that's your community radio report for this edition of Groundwire.
This week's Groundwire was coordinated by Carly Forbes and produced by Clementine Koenig of CKUT in Montreal, Gunarji O'Sullivan at CFRO Vancouver, and Nina Halliday, Rebecca Mears, Megan Thomas, and Frida Worden at CJSF Burnaby, BC. Tune in to your favorite radio station 2 weeks from today for the next episode of Groundwire. You can also find episodes of Groundwire online at the NCRA Program Exchange, Media Co-op, and RadioForAll.net. I'm Nina Halliday. Thanks for listening.